ago, first evidence of intelligent life off the Earth was discovered. It was buried 40 feet below the lunar surface, near the crater Titan. Except for a single, very powerful radio emission aimed at Jupiter, 4 million-year-old black monolith has remained completely inert. Its origin and purpose still a total mystery.
Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be happy. Very good. Motto to try to live by. Emphasis on all beings, all creatures great and small, all kingdoms of life, every member of every species of life, past, present, and future. That's a lot of beings. This is, of course, Jeff Phillips Wiferson coming at you with On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 5 in my new reactivated series, cumulatively numbered broadcast number 360 in Sedona, Arizona. It's a beautiful summer day, Garden of Eden weather. We've been so lucky to have a massive amount of rain the past week or so. They call it the monsoon season. It's a little like the wet season in Darwin, Australia, except for it's not that extreme yet. Today's show is based on the fact that here in Arizona, it's the 23rd of July, 2026. And that's a very special day to me because, as I've come to learn over many decades, according to all the research I've ever done, today in ancient Egypt was the beginning of their new year. And the reason being is because today, at that latitude, it's an astronomical phenomenon called the heliacal rising of Sirius. Heliacal means of or relating to the sun Helios. So the heliacal rising of Sirius, or any object that can be close to the sun can have a heliacal rising. What it actually means is, as the planets and stars move relative to each other, the sun finds itself in different constellations. Like right now it's in Canis Major, the big dog. And Sirius is the brightest star in that constellation. And so Sirius, for the past 70 days, Sirius has been so close to the sun that you can't see it because it's drowned out in the glare of the sun. And so on the heliacal rising of something, that means the first day that whatever object it is, but today it's for Sirius, is suddenly far enough from the sun to be discerned as a separate optical entity before sunrise. And so today in ancient Egypt, if it was clear, they could see Sirius as a star, probably just for a few minutes as it came out of the glare of the sun. And this was so important to them that this marked their new year, and it also marked the basic time of year when the Nile River flooded, which was their source of life. It flooded all their plains. I think they did a massive amount of irrigated agriculture. It just brought life. I mean, imagine not having much water for however long, 10 months. It's kind of like the dry season in Darwin, Australia. When that first water comes back, oh my God, everything just comes to life. I was actually in Kakadu National Park back in 2004. I went there for the first time and it was October. Everybody said it had not rained a drop in 10 months, which was long for there. And while I was there, I was sitting outside at a table at a cafe with no roof or anything, and all of a sudden, a small thunderstorm blew up, and it just rained really hard for like 45 minutes. And then the sun came out, and I go like, wow. But, I mean, man, that was so amazing, and how much stuff just instantly came to life. All kinds of birds and bugs and insects and creatures and stuff like that. It was transformed in a different world. 45 minutes of rain brought everything back to life. And so imagine what it was like in ancient Egypt when the Nile flooded. And I don't know how rapidly this happened. It probably happened over a period of days or weeks. I don't think it just came rushing in like a giant tsunami, but this people who know could find out. But the actual title of my show, now that I get around to it, is called Dog Star Rising, Sirius, Sol, Star Nations, and Sacred Moments. Sirius is the dog star because it's in the brightest star in the constellation Canis Major, the big dog. And I'm guessing that these constellations existed in the time of the ancient Greeks, but I think that the name is actually Latin, Canis. Sirius is the name of the brightest star in our sky, a blue-white star about 12 light-years away, so they say. Sol is one of many names for the sun, S-O-L. The star nations, collectively, are what I use to refer to all the entire family of all, everybody that's out there. The Earth, just being one tiny little, it's the third stone from the sun, according to Jimi Hendrix. The sun, one of billions and billions, according to Carl Sagan, of stars, just in our galaxy alone, and a universe of billions and billions and trillions and hexapillions of other galaxies, and maybe even other universes. I mean, it's just an infinite regress of possibility that may be a reflection of the structure of our own neurobiology. And sacred moments in time, a lot of sort of astronomical stuff, it's not really an event or a pinpoint in time, although a total solar eclipse has, it's, you know, the whole eclipse goes on for maybe half a day. There's only between, you know, maybe 30 seconds and 7 minutes of totality. So I'm always talking about windows of alignment, windows of time. We're just sort of at the tail end, maybe, depending on how you define it, of another window of time called the Encke window. That's what I call it, E-N-C-K-E, about Comet Encke, which is the late June, early July is when we pass through the debris stream of Comet Encke, and it creates two meteor showers, the North and Southern Taurids, T-A-U-R-I-D-S, because they seem to emanate from Taurus, kind of near the Pleiades, Matarik. And there's another meteor shower associated with an asteroid that's number 2014, a couple of letters after it, and they're called the Perseids, and they're in late October, early November, but there, that asteroid is believed to be associated with Comet Encke. So sacred moments in time, this is one of those to me, and it's a very special time in my life because I can say all this retrospectively that I've learned beliefs about the star Sirius, but it all goes back to one summer evening, just around this time of year, around the time of my mom's birthday in late July. And I already knew that they call it the dog days because it's the hottest time of year. I don't know why that has to do with dogs, but apparently the Greeks thought that because Sirius was the brightest star, that when Sirius reappeared, its heat added into the earth and made everything really hot. So there you go. Around this time of year, when I was 12 years old, that's Earth years, one summer evening, I just went outside in the backyard and it was dark and I wasn't really thinking any particular thing except I was just drawn to go out, or maybe I was called. I looked up at the stars and I don't remember what particular stars I might have seen. I know what it would have been overhead right then, the summer triangle with Vega, Deneb, and Altair. It's a giant triangle with three first magnitude stars. I don't think it's even anything I particularly saw. What I was doing was standing there, wide open, as the young boy I was, and kind of almost all of a sudden, it's like all of a sudden, just in within a second or two, some kind of feeling came over me or came to me or contacted me or reached out and touched me with some kind of spiritual awakening. Or there's just really no words I can find to describe this experience, but it was like all of a sudden a sense of awe and mystery and wonder just sort of expanded into my whole mind and my being. And I was looking at the sky and I was just like, oh my God, wow, what? It was almost like I'm going, who is this? Who is this calling me? Who is it that's waking me up to who might be there? There's not really words that I can say that convey the profundity and the impact of this fairly instantaneous experience, but it was like some kind of magic enchantment came down and surrounded me, because from then on, like even starting the next day, all I could do was think about astronomy, the stars. I wanted to look at them. I wanted to study them. I wanted to learn as much as I could about them. And so I became an extraordinarily avid amateur astronomer from that very day. And when I look back on this whole situation, I remember that something that might have contributed to be kind of a catalyst for this process was that my dad back then, who was the best dad, and my mom, the best mom and dad anyone could have, up until I smoked weed in my senior year in high school, and then they didn't like me anymore. But they were just extremely devoted, selfless parents that were, and especially my dad, was emphasized the extraordinary importance of education, and especially self-education, taking it on yourself to learn about that which is important. And I did, and that's been the story of my whole life. Anyway, he used to do a bit of traveling. He'd go to these educational conferences and be gone for a week or two, and he had just come back from one out west somewhere, and he had two books that he gave me, and one of them was called Worlds in Collision by Emmanuel Bielakovsky, and that has been a very influential book. A Russian psychoanalyst, and his big picture analyses are extraordinary, but this book was about how his hypotheses were that humanity had been traumatized by repeated planetary catastrophes that almost took us out, and that we refused to remember them because it was so horrific. And he talked about that. He talked about how a lot of the events described in the Old Testament that seemed kind of science fiction, that they could have actually happened because of certain astronomical stuff going on. Worlds in Collision, I mean, that kind of says it all. Anyway, but I was reading this when I was 12. The other book was a tiny little paperback called Pocket Guide to the Stars. It was a little miniature star atlas, about a small size of a small paperback book, with brilliant color photographs. It had a round star chart on the cover. And I was just, it was like a magic little portal to the universe. And so I started using that book, and maybe it was having that book that got me to go outside and look at the stars that night. But anyway, that happened, but that experience was so profound. It's like I would start staying up all night, bought a really super nice pair of binoculars, and then I saved up mowing yards all one summer and bought my first 35 millimeter camera, a Minolta SRT-101, and my very first photography using Kodachrome slide film was pictures of my Aunt Sarah's beautiful award-winning iris flowers, so many colors, and of astronomical stuff like the moon and Venus over in the western sky. And then I started learning how to do star trails, where you'd put the camera on a tripod, and as the earth rotated, it makes trails. Then I saved up and got a Unitron telescope, a small refractor, but enabled me to look up close at the moon and galaxies and the moons of Jupiter. I'll never forget the first night that I saw the moons of Jupiter. It was like March. It was a March morning. It was windy and fog was blowing. And I got up at like 3 o'clock in the morning to see the moons of Jupiter. I'll never forget how cool it was to see those little dots there. And, you know, and so this was when I was 12. So this carried on all the way through until when I graduated from high school and was going to go to college. I was going to be an astronomer. I wanted to be a professional astronomer. So I set out to, you didn't really start out majoring in astronomy, you started out as a physics major. So I was a physics major, and this began a whole new chapter of my life. Going to college, I'd been first in my class, science nerd, all these awards and honors and recommendations, scholarships to several different colleges in different states. Even though I had just been straight A student, when I got to college, my brain didn't really want to keep doing that same kind of stuff. It had mastered the left hemisphere stuff, and it needed right hemisphere nurturing, but I had no idea of that at the time. Looking back, I can say this. So I had trouble going to organic chemistry or advanced calculus at 8 o'clock in the morning. But my cultural anthropology course was extremely interesting. And so what I would do is go and check out a lot of books from the library, and then smoke a big fat joint, and then I would just spend days and days and days just researching on my own stuff that made sense. And a lot of it had to do with an astronomical perspective on being here now. It started branching into research about the perception of time, about cultural relativity. My physics lab instructor, Ray Stringfield, worked in the library, so I got to know him. And he was really cool, and it was he who turned me on to the writings of Dr. John C. Lilly. He told me about this book called The Mind of the Dolphin. And when I read that book, that was so magical to me, The Call of the Dolphins. It was the same exact feeling that I felt when I saw the stars that night that awakened me, feeling the same calling and energy coming from Lilly's dolphin work. It was amazing. And so I started reading all of Lilly's books and learning about the dolphins and everything. And then I realized that within an hour's drive of me, there was more dolphins in captivity than any place else in the world, other than maybe classified facilities. There was 27 dolphins in captivity at a training facility. And so I go like, wow, what? How did I never know about that? Or it's like you don't even think of dolphins if you're a land-loving Kakalakian. And so I tried to work out a deal with this dude where I could go and see him. He didn't want me just coming and hanging out, and especially after I told him about Dr. Lilly, because he knew who Lilly was. But he let me come one day and mow his grass in exchange for letting me hang out with the dolphins. And this was the first time I met dolphins in this lifetime. There was a big, beautiful mother dolphin and her little young female daughter. And they were so sad. They were inside this building, completely dark, concrete building, metal shed, in a pool. And I went in the door, and I could hear the water lapping and smell the chlorine, and I could hear them breathing. And I went and crouched down by the edge of the pool, and the mother kept her distance, but the young one came right over to me. It was like a 15-year-old girl, human. It had that exact kind of energy and spirit and joyfulness and stuff. And I just sort of, it came right up to me. And so I started stroking it and touching it and felt how smooth its skin was. And then she sort of turned over and I rubbed her tummy and stuff like that. But it was an extraordinary encounter. I felt their sadness. They were being held, they were prisoners in a concentration camp. And what this dude did was he caught these dolphins and then he trained them in different marine world kind of performance things. I ended up moving to California and I did a couple of workshops at the Esalen Institute with John Lilly and his wife, and that was very transformational. Anyway, all this goes back to that night when I was 12, during the dog days of summer. And I always felt something, before I ever learned anything about Egypt or Sirius or anything like that, I always just thought of this as a very magical time of year, because that's when that happened to me. And it was just like, at this time of year, it's like I feel that feeling. And especially now, being here in Sedona with the situation I've got and everything, it's a very powerful spiritual place. And so I'm going, well, look, is this serious connection? Is that some kind of real thing? And I thought, well, look, regardless of all the stuff that people write about, ancient stuff exists that wasn't concocted by New Age people. Like, for example, something that really jumped out at me was I read that, I think it was Aristotle, who was a very much of a natural scientist, he wrote that the dolphins disappear at the time of the dog star. So think about what that would mean. He must have observed this year after year after year. At the time of the dog star, which is about now, the dolphins disappear. And so where would they go? And why, and what did they do? So that's something I could follow up on and do a bit of research. But then I started learning about, you know, there was about the star Sirius, the connection with Sirius in ancient Egypt. And I've learned that, oh yeah, and by the way, the heliacal rising of something is totally dependent on your latitude. So I'm not sure exactly when the heliacal rising of Sirius would be at the latitude I'm at now. But at the latitude of the Great Pyramid, it's the 23rd of July, which is today. So I think it could be anywhere from a couple of weeks ago to a week or two from now. But again, like a lot of this astronomical stuff, it's a window of time, not a pinpoint. So I've learned that, according to Egyptologists, the thunder beings are coming. Just heard the first one of the day. The heliacal rising of Sirius. Sirius, they called it her Sothis, S-O-T-H-I-S. The heliacal rising of Sirius was represented the rebirth of Isis, who was their primary female deity, the sister and consort of the god Osiris, who, according to my Egyptologist friend Moira Timms, author of Beyond Prophecies and Predictions, she said to Jeff, Osiris was the Jesus of the Egyptians, or conversely, Jesus was the Osiris of the Christians. But he was a true, benevolent historical figure from like 20 or 30,000 years ago. But the story of Osiris and the story of Jesus is almost exactly the same story, with changing a few details. The flooding of the Nile, that makes sense. The regeneration of life. And one of their most important ceremonies and symbols, it's called the Jed. D-J-E-D, the Jedi. George Lucas spelled it wrong. It's D-J-E-D-I, the Jedi. The Jed pillar is a stylized vertebrae. It's like a backbone. It's Osiris's backbone. It's Osiris's vertebrae. And it's a symbol you can see in a lot of Egyptian art. They're like raising it. It's like at an angle. And the raising of the Jed was the ceremony where they would raise that from lying down into a vertical position at times of power, at times of need, the times of an initiation of a new leader, times of when they needed guidance or navigation, or to honor the heliacal rising of Sirius, which would be today. I'm guessing they would do the raising of the Jed today. Today would be a day of the empowerment of the Jedi. So, in reading about Sirius, a very influential book that I read was called The Sirius Mystery by Robert K. Temple. And it had stuff in there. For example, there's a tribe of people in Africa, in a country called Mali, M-A-L-I, called the Dogon, D-O-G-O-N. And the story goes that these anthropologists went there and learned from the Dogon that they worshipped the star Sirius, that beings from that star system had come here and visited them a long time ago, and they called them the Nammo, N-O-M-M-O, and they were part man and part fish, or amphibian, or maybe like mer people, partially aquatic. And that the Nammo taught them all their advanced knowledge and science and different kind of stuff. Kind of in the same way that the Darkinjung people of Queensland, Australia, say that a long time ago, the whales and dolphins taught their ancestors how to become people. So it's kind of a parallel story. Anyway, apparently, according to these anthropologists, the Dogon also knew that the star Sirius is a multiple star. There's three components to the star, Sirius A and Sirius B. And that they somehow knew that, and that they depicted it in their art and all this stuff. And anyway, people made a big deal out of it, but Carl Sagan, the astronomer, completely debunked this. And then other people have said, well, you know, maybe if the Dogon did actually believe this, maybe that story was brought to them by people that came there before those anthropologists, and they sort of assimilated it into their belief system. I mean, and this is all given that all these actors are behaving honestly. But if you look at this really intense investigative research book called The Stargate Conspiracy, The Truth About Extraterrestrial Life by Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince. I read this book many, many years ago when Douglas Webster from Hawaii told me about it. It basically says that all this New Age stuff about extraterrestrials and visitations and the pyramid, just all this stuff, is actually a big operation being foisted by shadowy factions of the secret world government, the intelligence community, all this stuff, in order to condition humanity to be prepared to accept our new Messiah. And I could believe this, and this is a very intense book. And I'm thinking now, in the world of today, we might be being prepared to accept the coming of a new Messiah called AI. And then there's also Rudolf Steiner, the Austrian brilliant thinker, writer, philosopher, educator, political activist. And I haven't delved into his work enough, but apparently he has several volumes, several books, exclusively written about the consciousness of different stars. You know, so I probably should have done that before I started recording this show, is to read up on what Rudolf Steiner thought about Sirius. That would be very interesting, to think of stars as beings, as conscious beings, which I've really come to do. I mean, how could they not be? Jeff, how dare you? That's not scientific. Now, this is very interesting. These are two relatively undeniable facts that go way back in time. Just like the statement from Aristotle about the dolphins disappearing at the time of the dog days. Now, I haven't been there to verify this myself, but you can read up in a number of different books and talk to people and stuff like that. And there's two things about the Great Pyramid that are very unique. One is that there is a shaft somewhere in the Great Pyramid that on a certain day of the year, at a certain time, if it's clear at night, the light of the star Sirius shines down through the shaft and illuminates a chamber. So what does that tell you? Having a chamber where whoever's in there is illuminated only by the light of Sirius, of a certain star. I mean, what did that do to you? Where did that send you? Did it take you to there? You know, but I mean, how intense of a thing is that? You know, to be able to do that, I mean, to engineer a shaft through mountainous walls of granite that was that perfectly aligned, and of course now with the precession of the equinoxes and different stuff like that, it may not align, or it might align at a different time and date, but I mean, that's pretty fucking freaky to me. The Egyptians, why did they go to all that trouble for something like that? And possibly related to this, possibly not, but related if only in the sense that it's another amazing, incomprehensible engineering feat that the ancient Egyptians did, is that if you go in the king's chamber, where the king's coffer is. It's like this giant bathtub-like thing, you know, that a person could lay down in. No markings, nothing on it at all. But the musician Paul Horn, who did some amazing musical recordings of his flutes and saxes inside the Taj Mahal, inside the Grand Canyon, inside a Russian cathedral. He recorded inside the Great Pyramid, and his Egyptologist friend told him that when he went in there to take his tuner, and if he strikes the king's coffer with his fist, it's going to resonate at 438 hertz. 438, not the so glorified 432, which is bullshit, and not A440, which is the standard tuning for middle A on a piano. 438. I mean, the difference between 438 and 440 is a lot of people couldn't really hear the difference. 2 hertz. So anyway, but Paul Horn, the first 3 sounds you hear on his CD inside the Great Pyramid are his fist striking the coffer, and spot on, 438 hertz. And so I'm going like, wow. So A, why did they choose that frequency? And B, how did they do that? How do you make a giant concrete bathtub that'll resonate at a fundamental frequency of a certain number? And then why that particular number? So those are the only two of amazing things I know about the Great Pyramid, other than stuff they say about all the mathematical proportions encoded into its geometry and its orientation. And it's like a model of the Earth, and maybe some people say it's like a messianic plan and all this different kind of stuff. So we can take pareidolia to the limit and sort of read into anything what exactly we want. And with AI will find this for you. It's really good at that. So anyway, but regardless, I think that these two things are measurable, concrete physical facts, that if that shaft aligns with Sirius and that frequency is 438, these are just two facts that don't necessarily tell us anything, except they do. They tell us the Egyptians were a freaky people, and that they probably weren't so concerned with the stuff of this regular world as they were with some kind of higher dimensions of their own sort of dream time. On this date, the 23rd of July, 1980, I was sitting in a workshop room at the Esalen Institute with John Lilly and his wife Toni, and several of their people that were working with the Human Dolphin Foundation, and a group of about 15 or 20 other people from all over the world that had come and done this week-long workshop. And it was mind-blowing. And so for me to be sitting there with John Lilly learning about the dolphins on July 23rd, on the date of this cosmic link between the Earth and Sirius, that was extremely transformative. The call of the dolphins and the call of the stars, it was the same thing. And it's also the same calling that brought me down to Australia and New Zealand in the year 2000. I really started feeling it in 1990 when I was living in Boulder, Colorado. But it was the exact same feeling. It's that magic feeling of that summer night when the stars were calling me. And then I realized the dolphins are part of that. And then I realized that Australia and New Zealand is part of it. And so I've traveled around Australia and New Zealand for 24 years. And I can look back and see that ever since that summer night, I've been traversing a cosmic song line. It's taken me through the awe and mystery of the universe. On my true spiritual path, that's what I always set out to follow. When I went to college to be an astronomer, I wasn't planning to get a high-paying job working for some engineering firm or my dad's company like almost everybody else I knew. I didn't know what I was going to do to make a living. I was following my heart. I wanted to understand the big picture of what all this meant. And that's exactly what I've been doing my whole life. I've never deviated from that. And the miracles just keep getting bigger and bigger. And the connections I've made and come to understand about the connections between human people and whale and dolphin people. And it's really confirmed what John Lilly asserted in Mind of the Dolphin that he wrote, like, I think in 1971, that the whales and dolphins are a form of extraterrestrial intelligence. They're not from another planet, they're from here, but they're from a very different environment, the ocean. But that to approach them in that kind of way is the only way we can really understand them. We can't think of them as animals. We can't, but most people do. I could tell you a shocking story. Oh my God, what just happened with this guy that works for the Department of Conservation in New Zealand 2 days ago. He cannot even remotely think of whales in the same breath as people. To understand that there's been beings on this planet with brains and minds light years beyond ours, that they've been here basically in their present genetic form for 30 million years. Us, a million, half a million, we don't know. But they've been here a lot longer than us and living in the ocean, which is a much more stable environment than the land. And maybe that's why they return to the ocean from living on the land. A big thing that I talk about in a lot of my shows and my cosmology and my big picture is the kind of the cyclical nature of life on Earth, and the Hopi prophecy and the Hindu cosmology talk about sort of seasons of a galactic year. And the Hopis don't really divide it into seasons, but they call it worlds. They say we're living in the fourth world because the previous three, these are the worlds of human civilization. The previous three were destroyed and or destroyed themselves because of their grotesque violation of the true spiritual path, which is how we're really supposed to live. The path that I think describes how the indigenous people of Australia lived up until the time of the European invasion, and how the whales and dolphins live now. The whales and dolphins and the indigenous people of Australia seem to have been immune to whatever driving factors are that cause these cyclical variations, that cause the progression of the seasons of the yugas, that cause the growth and exponential metastasis of the military-industrial civilizations that have become such a danger to the Earth. Mother Earth and the Great Spirit has to wipe the slate. And I really feel that we're right on the brink of that happening again now. Out of necessity, out of absolute necessity for the remaining, whoever might survive, purification. It all ties together. What was extraordinarily powerful is that 2 days ago, on Monday, my friend Cameron from Arcosanti, which is this kind of alternative, architecturally unique community between here and Phoenix, he came and drove us up to this place called Monument Valley. It's near the Four Corners area. It's on the Navajo Reservation, and it kind of straddles the border between Arizona and Utah. But this whole area, this whole part of the country, it's one of the planetary vortexes or energy grids, a power spot or planetary chakra for the whole planet. Kind of like this area, it's kind of comparable to Uluru, the big red rock in the center of Australia, although Monument Valley, although it's Navajo tribal land and a few people live there, not many. It's got a 17-mile loop that you can drive, and it takes you among all these giant, they're like plateaus. They're kind of like, they're these giant rock plateaus that rise up above the Amazon jungle in Venezuela. They're called the Tepui, T-E-P-U-I-S. These are like smaller versions of desert Tepui. They're not rising up above jungle, they're rising up above red desert. But they've got sort of vertical central parts with slopes of scree around the base. And first I thought they were volcanic chimneys, kind of like the Glasshouse Mountains in Queensland, but apparently they're sandstone. But they're very, very imposing, and they're kind of like IMAX versions of all the rocks and the vortex rocks here in Sedona. But these are the IMAX version, in the same way that Chile is like the IMAX version of the South Island in New Zealand. Monument Valley is the IMAX version of Sedona. It's got all these giant rock formations and each of which would have a name, each of which would have its own unique energetic properties and spiritual characteristics. And very interestingly, the first one that we are inspired to stop at, I hadn't even looked at my map. I didn't know what it was called, but I started playing my flute and trying to connect with this giant rock, thank it for letting us come there. And lo and behold, I find out that it's called Rain God Mesa. I'm like, holy fuck. Because I've been so intimately connected with the rain beings, the thunder beings, and the lightning beings here, and the rain divas here in Sedona the past couple of weeks. We've had massive rain, massive thunderstorms. There's a giant thunderstorm coming right this very second. You might hear some of the thunder in the recording. They come every day, and the thunder beings, and I play my flute and drum to them, and it's really like there's a connection. Even last week, before we went to Monument Valley, I was kind of like, well, I wonder where these thunder beings come from. If they come from a certain area, or a certain, you know, place, or... And so when I saw this giant rain god mesa, I went like, oh my god, what if this is where they come from? What if this is the home of all the thunder beings in this part of the country? And I'm like, oh my god. It's the kind of thing, if I was able to delve into, find some traditional Navajo people, they might be able to tell me, but it all has to do with water. It has to do with water, and it relates with, the dolphins relate with water, and rain, life on Earth, and the flooding of the Nile, and to have visited Monument Valley, very close to the heliacal rising of Sirius, very, very, very powerful things to do at a certain sacred moment in time. And so I guess I'm, in a rambling way, I'm just kind of free associating a connection between all these different events and things in my life that all weave together that kind of tell the story of who I am and what I do and why I've gone and done what I've done, being here now and what I'm doing. But this makes sense of it, this background. It's amazing that we're here. It's amazing that any of us are here and that we have the freedom and opportunity to be awake and aware of the beauty of nature and the earth. And when you actually pause and think about the mysteries of it, it's just so mind-blowing. You're like, wow, we know absolutely nothing. We can suspect this, we can hypothesize that, we can extrapolate to this or that. We can write articles and publish books and make movies and go on speaking tour about all the expertology. But what do we really know? We know what we can see and hear and feel and touch, that we are not alone on this planet in any kind of way. I mean, anybody that ever said that, I mean, what does it even mean? We're alone? Alone in what sense? We aren't. How could we possibly be alone? Even if it's just you on the Earth, it's you and Mother Earth. But we've got an infinite number of fellow beings. And I think the people that started with the "we are alone" thing are, we're alone in being the only beings with intelligence. Nay, nary, nay, day. Oh, fucking contrary. Sorry about that. No. We're probably the least truly intelligent being that exists. No being that was truly intelligent would be doing their utmost to destroy and harm and desecrate the beautiful planetary being that's giving them birth and letting us be here. I'm listening to the sound of the water in my little bubble fountain, my bubble oracle. I guess that's about all I have to say. But yeah, today's the heliacal rising of Sirius, the dog star, a time to think of the rebirth of life and the cosmic connection. Some people think that the dolphins and whales actually came here from Sirius. There's actually planets with water and water-based life in the Sirius star system. So what if something like that's true? What if this Egyptian connection, they knew about something like this? This is the magic and mystery of the world that we really live in. One aspect of the knowledge and wisdom of whales and dolphins that I think I've been exploring and that I think really exists, I call it cetacean dreamtime astronomy. It was a wave of inspiration that came in conjunction with connecting with certain Aboriginal people in Australia back around 2016. Cetacean Dreamtime Astronomy was a series of paintings and artwork that I did, rocks that had astronomical constellations and patterns that, based on mega constellations that the Polynesian navigators used, it made me think of and be aware of the idea that whales and dolphins have extremely advanced knowledge of astronomy in some of the ways that we do with what you'd call naked eye astronomy, where you're just looking with your eyes, you're not using any sort of optical assistance like binoculars or telescopes or anything like that, or cameras. But you can do a lot with naked eye astronomy. I mean, that's how we've done it. Probably for like 99.999% of our existence as human beings, we've done everything without any external technology, just like the whales and dolphins and everybody else on this planet now, except for us. Cetacean Dreamtime astronomy, it's not only about the pragmatic process of navigating where you are and getting from A to B on the Earth. With the whales and dolphins, it's probably partially astronomical, but it might be involved many other forms of sensation and perception, like geomagnetism, like birds and insects and all kind of different sensitivities. And if you start looking into Polynesian navigation, as I did a bit when I was in Hawaii the year before last, it's very complex. And they, you know, the master navigator is like a very finely tuned instrument. And he's wide and awake, probably hardly sleeps on the trip. And he's watching for all kinds of subtle clues. Some might make sense, some might be extremely esoteric. Like I've heard that they can look at the waveforms reflecting in the water as the waves bounce off the hull of the boat, and they can read information from that, and reading how the waves move themselves. And then there's stuff like wind and birds and insects and stuff in the water, stuff that would make sense to tell you if you're close to land, but how do you know which land it is? And to look up at the sky and see the stars at night, and you're in the middle of the ocean, and to kind of know where you're going, like to aim for Hawaii if you're leaving from the Marquesas or Rapa Nui or Taiwan. I mean, imagine that. And imagine the whales and dolphins and many other fellow beings that navigate. They're just in their body. They're not even in a boat or a ship or a submarine. And they just do this. And I won't say they do it without thinking about it, but it's their nature. It's their nature to do stuff that we consider to be miraculous. And they don't have to go to extraordinary lengths to do it. They just only need to be worried when we start interfering with that, as we're doing across the full spectrum of every life form on this planet. So I'm pretty convinced that whales and dolphins have advanced astronomical knowledge of our heliocosmic context, and probably out to a much larger radius of influence than that. But they know what's going on. They know where the planets are. They know the phases of the moon. They know what else might be in or moving towards the solar system. Other planets, rogue planets, asteroids, comets, unknown bodies. And I'm pretty sure that they're actually perceiving. I won't use the word see, because it may not be visual, but they're able to directly sense and feel something that's near the solar system that's going to be involved in the catastrophic regeneration process that the Hopi call the Day of Purification. I'm pretty convinced this is an actual scenario that's unfolding now, and that it's not just a random process, that it is being guided by levels of intelligence that we can't even appreciate. And I think the whales and dolphins are part of this. But I also think, now I'm painting a full-on science fiction scenario here, but it's not science fiction. You can call it science friction because of the insistent reality to it. If people even accept part of it as real, it's going to create a lot of friction. It's going to burn out their brake pads, and it's going to burn out, it's going to melt a hole where they're putting their pedal to the metal. It's just going to melt right through. And their whole foot's going to go out and scrape on the ground like Fred Flintstone. A catastrophic event is going to come out of the blue. And this is where I think, I've been meaning to tell you about this extremely cool, it's actually a series of videos that this guy, he's made these videos. And the first one's called What the Dinosaurs Saw at Chicxulub. This is the impact 66 million years ago that they think took out the dinosaurs, and it crashed the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. This video is about 12 minutes long, And it's very, very freaky because it's probably a lot like what could have been seen if somebody was here then that could tell us about it now. And I think the whales and dolphins were. I think their ancestors remember witnessing that. It looks like a point of light, kind of like a large fuzzy star that's moving slowly from night to night, slightly even position. Weeks and weeks and weeks, months and months and months, and then as it gets closer and closer, it's moving in the sky, and then it starts kind of like moving where you can actually see it in a different position from hour to hour, and then it drops down, and then as it gets closer, it turns into a disc. It looks kind of like a moon, only partially illuminated because the sun's below the horizon. It's like a crescent moon on this body that's moving, but it's large enough to see, but it's big. And then as it gets closer and closer to the horizon, then all of a sudden, as it enters the Earth's atmosphere, a blinding flash of light like an atomic explosion. And then that's when the shit starts hitting the fan. And the way he did these videos, it is absolutely mind-blowing, because he's got this one that goes up into the point of impact and the flash, and then he's got another one that's about 3 or 4 hours long that shows his impression of what would have happened if people were on the Earth at that time, or if something like that happened now. And it shows animated graphics that show the spread of the shockwave and the fires and the tsunami and the death toll expanding out across North America. It's just mind-blowing that this dude made these films, and he's actually got other ones about other impacts, and I haven't had a chance to watch those yet, but on the Heliacal Rising of Sirius, that would be a great day to watch something like that. But yeah, Cetacean Dreamtime Astronomy, they're able to sense or feel what's happening in this local universe because they're extremely highly adapted beings that live in the ocean, a giant liquid crystal body of water, ultimate saline solution, an aqua terrestrial intelligence. They're able to feel what she feels. And think of the ocean of the Earth as a giant antenna for what's going on. And if you can tune into that, it'll tell you more than a zillion radio telescopes linked up with AI and supercomputers, and in real time. It doesn't have to be processed, it can just be felt or known. They can feel and probably even form images of what's going on inside their shared collective consciousness. That they can beam information like this, a holographic burst, in a millisecond that conveys more information than I could talk about in a year of speaking in Indo-European language like English. So much to think about. The dolphins may well have specific knowledge or connection, or like we have all these words that we use to describe our own internal reality, but it may or may not even apply to beings that are light years beyond us psychologically, neurobiologically. But they may have their own conceptions of Sirius and all the other bright stars. I mean, this would be part of understanding Cetacean Dreamtime Astronomy. If you look at the myth and the lore and the story of all the different heavenly bodies as told or expressed by all the indigenous people of the Earth, those would be in the same category as that, only it's not human indigenous people, it's the indigenous people of the sea. So imagine, if you dare, that we could tap into and be allowed access to understanding Cetacean Dreamtime Astronomy. A lot of this is coming through in my artwork. One more footnote on the Egyptian cosmological story that I've developed over the decades is I used to just be the biggest fan of the Great Pyramid. It was the coolest thing that's ever been built by human people, maybe pre-Atlantis, maybe extraterrestrials, how they moved all those blocks and oriented it. You know, it's still very much of a mystery how it was done. People, you know, like Eric von Däniken would say, of course, it's extraterrestrials. And just like the plane of Nazca in Peru, that's the only explanation he could see. Well, I always assumed that the pyramid was built for positive life-oriented purposes. But in recent years, I've started to question that. And I think to myself, well, what exactly is it? What does it do? It's a tetrahedron, which is a very regular, it's the simplest regular solid that can exist in geometry, tetrahedron, and all those angles. And what exactly is it doing? I mean, has it been sitting there empty and inactive all these years as an initiation complex or temple for important people to travel to the heavens or their spirit to ascend. I just saw that there's two shafts, the Great Pyramid. One goes from the King's Chamber to the Belt of Orion. The other one goes from the Queen's Chamber to Sirius. So what this means, I have no idea in how they would use it. But in my mind, I'm going like, well, look, what if there's even more to it than that? Why would they build something like that just for the spiritual souls of their leaders? And maybe they were that important, but what if it's got other Atlantean geoengineering level properties that we don't even know about, like just its presence on the Earth and where it is strategically located at what's some people think is one of the key chakras of the whole Earth, sort of like the Pilbara and Australia, like Uluru maybe, or like the Four Corners, where I've just been at two of these, actually three if you want to call Maui one. Apparently the Great Pyramid is one of these. So what if it's actually bringing down and or blocking really important energies that has to do with Earth's connection with water-based life? What if it's bringing down energies that has to do with solid-state intelligence? Or what if it's actively blocking energies that has to do with the health and well-being of water-based life? And it's all something to think about. And not that all the ancient Egyptians were on the same page. Everything's so complex. So may we all be peaceful. May we all be happy. All beings. Loka, Samasta, Sukhina, Bhavantu. Kia ora. Jeff Phillips Weverson signing off on the Brink Radio, broadcast number 360, broadcasting at 21 centimeters. G'day.
Origin and purpose, still a total mystery.